Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to episode 7 of season 2 of the Afghan Eye podcast. My name is Sangar Paikar.
And I'm Ahmed Walid Khakar.
In today's episode, we will be covering the UN-led conference on Afghanistan held in Qatar on the 18th and 19th of February and the Pakistani general elections. To our listeners and viewers, welcome to the show. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like the video, subscribe, and leave a comment. To all our listeners, please make sure to leave a review on whichever podcast platform you're listening to. That will help us a lot. If you appreciate our work and if you like to support us, please visit our Patreon page to become a patron. And if you like to make a single donation, please visit our PayPal page. Now, with that out of the way, Ahmed Walid Khakar, how are you doing?
Allah, alhamdulillah. It's been an eventful period, not just generally in world geopolitics. There's a lot going on. There's been stuff obviously going on in Afghanistan and also neighboring in Pakistan. But other than that, it's smooth sailing so far. How have you been?
Alhamdulillah, doing well, being busy, sorting out a few things for the Afghan Eye. And I'm excited for today's show because two very significant events on a regional scale happened. So first and foremost, the conference in Doha. We weren't invited, but we weren't.
But just before we talk about the conference in Doha, completely unrelated. I'm aware that it looks like I basically wear the same thing in every show, but I'm wearing different colors, but because of the lighting setup, I'm a bit limited with regard to space and how much lighting I can put up. You know, last time I wore black, the other time I wore burgundy, this time I'm wearing navy. But the moment I sit in this setup, I just look like I'm wearing the exact same thing all the time. But yeah, if we ever do get invited to Doha, I'll make sure to not wear this.
Okay, well, you can also try to play dress up like me with all different outfits every time. All right, okay, so there was a international conference on Afghanistan in Doha on the 18th and 19th of February. Can you provide an overview of what the conference was about?
Sure, so the conference involved 25 attendants ranging from the representatives of different states, NGOs, women's rights groups, Afghan people that are commonly considered to be Afghan civil society activists, things of the sort. And what the conference aimed to do was to provide a platform or a forum for discussions with regard to Afghanistan and the legal and the diplomatic limbo in which it's existed to progress and move forward. It's important to realize, or remember rather, that this happens in the larger framework and context of there being talks of the appointment of a special UN envoy to Afghanistan to facilitate that process of, if you want to call it, rehabilitation of Afghanistan to reoccupy its seat on the world stage, or to allow the current government in Afghanistan to function in some way in these different platforms and fora. That suggestion as to a special UN envoy has been vociferously objected to by Kabul. And this conference essentially was a way, or attempted way, to try to accelerate those discussions, to bring Afghanistan once again to the forefront of the agenda and raise some of the different challenges and issues that still exist within the country. So within all of these attendants, like I said, the different representatives included people, you know, diplomats from the United States, from the EU, from China, as well as others, as I'm sure we'll cover later on, that declined to attend.
Yeah,
or were not invited.
Interesting. But what I think is also relevant for our viewers and listeners to know is, why would such an important event be held in a place like Doha? Can you explain that?
Well, we covered in our previous episode how there was a conference, an unprecedented one, that was convened in Kabul by the Afghan government. And so location ultimately matters. The fact, for example, that a conference was convened then by the Afghan government in Kabul was a power move, right? And so convening such thing in Doha, first of all, Doha has gained, rightly or wrongly, their reputation or the image as being something of a place in which different Afghan factions are able to come together and work out a solution. It was, of course, the site of the Doha agreement between the United States and then the Taliban, now obviously re-established as the Islamic Emirate. So Doha has a kind of feel and that feel-good vibe to it where problems get solved. In addition to that, of course, many of the leaders of the Taliban who are on sanctions lists are really and truly unable to travel elsewhere. So Doha is, in the instance, or assuming that the Taliban were to attend, it's somewhere where they're familiar and they know that no harm would be forthcoming to them. So those are really, and once again, the fact that this is a conference being convened and the Taliban are being invited to it, but they're not the ones convening the conference. This is a conference being convened by an outside body to which the Taliban are invited. So it's not going to take place in Afghanistan. It's going to take place somewhere outside of Afghanistan, which the Taliban would only be participants or attendants or visitors.
Okay, so on the eve of this event, we received notifications on our phones, a number of notifications saying that the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has decided not to attend the conference. Obviously, they wrote a long statement with their reasons why they are not attending the conference. How do you assess this decision, on like a last minute decision?
Well, I personally saw it coming because if you recall, in our previous podcast, we discussed the Chinese recognition thing, and we came out on a limb and we basically said, guys, this is recognition, right? It just hasn't been declared. And we quoted Afghan experts who essentially said the same thing as well. And those Afghan experts also said, and by them I mean Abdulhay Qanit and Omar Samad, that China at the presidential level receiving the Afghan ambassador designate not only is recognition, but would also pull the rug out from beneath the feet of diplomats in Western capitals who are looking for some way to re-engage with Kabul under the Taliban. So given that we've all established, and the argument that I'm making is on the assumption that we all agree that this is recognition, just short of announcing it, we then foresaw that this would embolden the Taliban and make them more likely to be able to withstand Western pressure or criticism or anything of the sort. Essentially, as we would say, as it would be said in London slang, if and when pressure is brought to bear on the Taliban from the West, the Taliban response would be, you ain't that guy anymore. You're not built like that. You haven't got those minerals, right? We've got other friends now, right? We're not the loner in the playground. We've got a big bad guy who's our friend now. So we are now able to essentially withstand that pressure. So I approached this announcement that they wouldn't be attending with that in the back of my mind, that the ball game is different here. You ain't that guy anymore. And in the run-up to this conference that was ultimately convened in their absence, what we saw was that the UNAMIR head, Rosa Otunbayeva, was routinely meeting the Afghan foreign minister, Amir Khan Muttaqi, and there was talk about the UNAMIR is essentially the United Nations Afghanistan assistance mission, something of the sort. And they were talking about constructive engagement where it mattered and things of the sort. So the indications were that, you know, these minor differences would be overcome and the conditions that the Taliban had set for their attendance would maybe be dropped or be met. So the abrupt announcement that they wouldn't attend may have taken others by surprise. But to be honest with you, I saw it coming and I'll also add, I foresee more such instances occurring in the future, more of an assertive posture from Kabul.
So, to be very specific, what were those two conditions set by Kabul?
I would say that, I mean, we heard from Zabihullah Mujahid, and Zabihullah Mujahid laid out two conditions, but really and truly, it's one condition, because the second is only a branch or a corollary of the first, which is that I mentioned earlier on that Afghan civil, so people that are considered Afghan civil society activists, whether rightly or wrongly, we'll discuss some other time, but other Afghans that are not part of this government would be in attendance in this conference. Zabihullah Mujahid said that there were two conditions, that the Taliban-led government in Kabul would have to be considered as the sole representative of the Afghan state, as in this Afghan government would do all of the representing of Afghanistan at this forum, and thereby it would engage in discussions on that basis. And essentially what that means is that the Afghan, quote, civil society activists would not be in attendance, right? And it would engage multilaterally with that sort of status, which was obviously not accepted by the UN, and Antonio Guterres said so either.
A question that was raised actually by a US-based journalist, Akmal Dawi, who works for Voice of America. He wrote on X that why does the United Nations decide who is a representative of Afghan civil society, which sparked a lot of debate, like indeed, who are these people, on what grounds are they selected, and why does the United Nations feel like these people should have a say at the table? And I think, you know, these questions resonate with a lot of Afghans, because I was at the start of the show, I said jokingly they didn't invite us, because if we...
I was about to say the same. We haven't, I mean, I may wear or look like I wear the same thing in every podcast, but I don't have a track record of alleged corruption, and neither do you. And we are just as much civil society Afghans. We're foreign based, just like many of the civil society activists are as well. So, you know, Antonio Guterres, if he ever gets around to listening to this, maybe he should consider inviting us, because there's no reason why we shouldn't be there and others are.
And the thing is like, I'm not here openly calling for my inclusion in all.
Nazardir Spinstergeyam, I'm calling off the bat.
No, but seriously, like, okay, if it's about having some sort of clout, okay, who of all these people who they regularly talk to can travel all across rural Afghanistan without having a security detail and all sorts of things? We can do that. We can go anywhere we want. We can sit with anyone we want. We can talk with anyone we want. Whether it's in Afghanistan or here in the West, we are basically capable of engaging anybody. But yet, for some reason, they don't approach us. They do approach the people who have gained so much, you know, influence only by being, you know, how do you describe that in a very polite way? So basically, the foreigners gave them all the money and resources and put
and the beneficiaries of foreign occupation.
Yes, and now they are being presented as representatives of Afghan civil society. None of them has ever won any elections, to my knowledge. But yet, here we are with those faces, and not us.
Unfortunately, that's this is honestly the case. And unfortunately, you know, the people who we could consider beneficiaries of the occupation that was such a failure that the Taliban came back to power are now the ones that are exiled civil society activists. And like you said, neither do we have blood on our hands, nor are we accused of widely, including by US government bodies, of having embezzled US taxpayer money. So if anyone, I mean, like you said, we are civil society activists much as they are. We share in common the fact that we are based overseas. And like I said, in exile to an extent, due to the people, due to the people now in exile themselves.
Yeah. And okay, so moving on. So the government announced that they're not going to participate in this conference. During the conference and shortly after that, a number of significant figures attending the conference or in general, they issued statements. So we heard a statement from the Chinese envoy, the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan, Thomas West. He has also issued a statement. And also Russia and UN Secretary General Guterres. Let's go through these statements. So first and foremost, the Chinese, who have sort of more or less recognized the emirate, they issued a statement.
Yes, so the Chinese envoy, and once again, the pronunciation may be an issue here, Chinese envoy Yu Zhaiyong expressed regret that the United Nations meeting failed to facilitate dialogue with the Taliban. And Yu Zhaiyong essentially, he's basically on Kabul's side here. He said that this was a useful platform for discussions to be had. However, that it was spoiled by the fact that meaningful discussion or dialogue could not be had with the Taliban. But like I said, Yu Zhaiyong represents the government that is the first to recognize and receive a Taliban ambassador at the presidential level. So one could say that it's his government that has emboldened the tribal Taliban to act so insolently toward the West. So that was the Chinese envoy. Then we heard from the US special envoy to Afghanistan, Thomas West, and he put out in a tweet or in a tweet thread, and I'll paraphrase this, just go through this very quickly. He said that he and his assistant, who is Rina Amiri, who is the special assistant for the special envoy for Afghan women, obviously no special envoys for Palestinian women being butchered by American weapons. But anyways, they participated in discussions with envoys from 24 countries and organizations. There's a consensus that no one wants to see terrorism emerge from Afghanistan on women going to school and essentially partaking in public life as normal. Aid to Afghanistan, acknowledging the cutting of poppy cultivation. And finally, the US welcomes, and this is the direct quote, the US welcomes continuation of this format as well as calls for a UN-led process to develop a roadmap for Afghanistan's full integration into the international system. The Afghan people's well-being and the international community's shared interests must guide this work. So the key takeaway there, in addition to everything else that I mentioned, is that the continuation of this format and calls for a UN-led process to develop a roadmap for Afghanistan's full integration into the international system. What this sounds like to me, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts as well, is the normalization of the new Afghanistan. Obviously, it's been normalized to a large extent, not entirely within Afghanistan, but also on a global level. Then we had the UN General Secretary, who confirmed that he'd received a letter from Kabul with its conditions for attendance, which he said were basically full recognition of the Taliban-led government as the Afghan government and full normalization, which he couldn't accept. But he said that we want an Afghanistan in peace, peace with itself and peace with its neighbors, and able to assume the commitments and the international obligations of a sovereign state in relation to the international community, its neighbors, and in relations to the rights of its own people. There was also consensus on the process to reach this objective. So that is essentially the state of play. Finally, the other major player is Russia. Now, Russia, we've covered Afghan-Russian relations pretty extensively on this podcast, even with regard to since the Taliban's takeover. Now, the Russian embassy in Kabul posted a statement on Facebook written in Pashto. Whilst we appreciate the attempt, Google Translate didn't. This is terrible, Pashto. But what the Russian embassy statement here details that Kabul's conditions were not accepted. And Russia said that in this regard, so the Russian Federation, in accordance with the request of the Afghan officials, in accordance with the request by the Afghan officials, abstained from the ceremony or the gathering, and in this regard was thanked for its principled decision by Kabul. So once again, this comes back to what I said at the beginning of the podcast. You ain't built like that anymore, is essentially the message that's being given to the West. China has 99%, as the former Afghan ambassador to Canada and France told us, recognized the Taliban. And Kabul's, let's say, influence or clout is to the extent that upon its request, Russia declined participation in this meeting. Now, this itself is significant. Now, the only thing that remains is, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, is, was this the right decision to make? Did the Taliban do the right thing here, or perhaps a miscalculation or a strategic failure? Because a former Afghan intelligence chief, Rahmatullah Nabil, said that this was a strategic failure, to which I responded that it takes a strategic failure like Rahmatullah Nabil to recognize a strategic failure. I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts.
Okay, so what is very interesting to note here, not just Rahmatullah Nabil, but Ali Ahmad Jalali, a former defense minister during the occupation, and all these outspoken critics of the Taliban who are basically have been advocating for a civil war, another invasion for the past 2.5 years, they are all out here condemning Taliban for not attending a UN-led conference in Doha. So the question that needs to be answered here is, if you don't want the Taliban to get any kind of recognition, or if you are opposed to engagement with the Taliban, because let us be very specific, this is exactly what they have been advocating for, then why are you upset if they decide not to attend that conference? This basically means that the agenda behind this whole conference was to somehow exert pressure on Kabul. And the conditions, as mentioned by Zabihullah Mujahid, for their participation in this event were not met. So they consequently decided not to participate. To me, it seems like they made a very strategic calculation. And like, if the deck is laid out in your favor, which is the case, to be honest, considering what has happened with China, other developments in the region, like with Russia, to which we will return later on in the show, considering all those regional dynamics, the conference in Kabul on the 29th of January that we have discussed previously in the show, all of this reveals that there is a shift, and the Taliban are very well aware of the shift. And to them, it doesn't really matter if they sit across the table talking with America and the rest of the allies of the United States in a conference that already doesn't give them their due credit by just inviting them as one of the other players in Afghanistan, when in reality there are no real other players. They are basically the only game in town. So for this reason, I think that the decision was very strategic. And I also think that we should move past this dynamic from the era of the occupation, where they think, okay, we can somehow cajole them into one direction. It's not happening. It's not going to happen. Things are moving to a different direction, and it would have been a fruitful conversation if the dynamics of this whole conference were laid out in a different way, but that they decided not to attend. I mean, no major disaster has occurred ever since. So I think it was a rational and very calculated decision.
I would add to that, if you look at what's been said by the major actors or the major stakeholders of this conference, you have the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, who praised the Taliban's counter-narcotics efforts and confirmed that there is an overwhelming consensus that everyone wants peace in Afghanistan. Everyone wants Afghanistan to be able to pledge some form of humanitarian assistance to Afghanistan. No one wants Afghanistan to go to war. The same call is echoed by the US Special Envoy, Thomas West. The full integration of Afghanistan into the international system. And then you have the Chinese envoy saying that it's regrettable that this was not an opportunity, or the opportunity to engage in meaningful dialogue with Kabul was missed. And then you have the Russians not attending the conference per the Taliban's request. So all of these things that come out of the conference, if you're looking at this from Kabul's perspective, you listen to what Gutierrez says and you say, okay, I like that. You listen to what the US envoy says, okay, I like that too. The Chinese are playing ball as well. They're not saying anything that's diametrically opposed to what you want. And the Russians have even played. You're thinking, they got everything they wanted without even attending the party. So I would say,
okay, calculated. Now you are basically coming to a very, very sensitive matter. Okay, so this is, I think, for most of our listeners and viewers, is very important to note, is that all these international events that you see, a bilateral or multilateral conferences on regional or global politics that are being held across the globe, from what is apparent, it seems like these important figures need to come together and talk, and within 1 or 2 days sort out everything. That's not how it works. In reality, long before the conference is being held, or when the date is even decided for such a conference, all these different actors, they talk to one another and they sort out their differences and they try to come to an agreement. The conference is usually a formality. It's for the press, it's for the international community, everyone else to say, okay, this or that was decided on that day. But that's not really what is happening, because the decisions are made in advance. So with all these diplomatic back channels, with all these conversations that going on behind closed doors, whether it's in Doha or in Kabul or in other neighboring countries, we know that what is being discussed and what is being presented as a new approach is already sort of more or less clear to all actors. So the fact that the Taliban, they said, oh, so this is what they want to do, this is what they want to say.
Nah, I'm all right, you know. I think I'll give it a miss. You're basically getting something for nothing. So you guys enjoy yourselves. I'll sit this one out.
Yeah, so this is why I think if we correctly assess this whole situation, basically the Taliban are playing a very advanced form of chess here. And they're only capable of doing this is because of the changes in global politics. Because now they have options. They can choose what to do. It's not like they are begging for recognition. They're begging to be accepted. because look at what they do without recognition. They are paying off their debts to neighboring countries for electricity bills. There is investment going on in Afghanistan. There's development going on. I mean, that's even more than the previous government that was officially recognized. So based on that, what do you expect from these people? What should they do?
The perspective now is recognition would be nice, but, you know, whatever. Life goes on. But I wanted to... So, yeah, essentially, the short and the long story is this conference, they got something from nothing. And like you said, strategic, calculated. And I would say since then, the sky hasn't come collapsing down. Looks like it was a success. But I wanted to point out, and I'm not sure if you saw recently, there was an American journalist, Tucker Carlson, who's undergoing what seems to be something of a shift in his perspective, not just on America and in sort of internal American dynamics, but also, of course, how America interacts with the world. So he recently visited, maybe he's still there, I don't know, but he recently visited the Kremlin, did an 2-hour interview with Putin. So bearing in mind that the Russians, obviously not out of the kindness of their own hearts and their insatiable love for Afghanistan, but on the basis of their own interests and their own calculations, didn't attend this conference. Did you watch that interview of Tucker Carlson with Putin? I'll ask firstly.
Yes, I did watch the interview immediately when it was released.
You know what's crazy? It's the fact that I don't think a lot of people realize this. It's that we live in a time and an age where you can see the world, a leader of one of the major global powers, sit for 2 hours and talk about how his neighbor is fake and doesn't deserve to exist. That stuff didn't happen before. People don't really realize this. It really is weird. A major world powers leader sits down for 2 hours and dedicates an hour of it entirely just to shitting on his neighbor. It's remarkable. But the point I wanted to ask is, how do you rationalize this Russian decision to abstain from attending this conference in light of more, you know, the increasing awareness of Putin's perspective on the world as displayed by this interview?
Okay, so first of all, we have to identify Putin as a person with a very long history. He used to be in the KGB, okay? So he is actually a spy by profession, and he's now the leader of Russia. And what the KGB did, and now it's called the FSB, and what they're doing still, what they're still doing, and this is something that people really need to understand and become more aware of, is that unlike the West, the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, they pay close attention to everything that is happening in the West. They do not look at the West with contempt, and they do not look at the West as, oh, these idiots, and they don't constantly try to basically make the West look like ignorant people. No, they actually try to understand what's going on, and then they try to make their decisions in a very calculated manner. If you want to learn more about this, you should definitely listen to interviews of Yuri Bezmenov on YouTube. He's a former KGB agent who defected to United States somewhere in the late 70s.
Is he the one that has an interview talking about how postmodernism will destroy Russia from within? Sorry, destroy the United States from within.
Yes.
Is this the same guy?
Yuri Bezmenov, that's him. He has two long interview. No, he has one interview, and there is another video of him where he basically lectures a group of people about subversion. So it is very important for people to understand how these people operate, the KGB, how they operated during the Cold War. And it's not like everything has changed ever since. So what Putin did, and what is very important to understand, is that he played into a vacuum that has emerged in the West, where the politicians only talk in bite size for news consumption. They do not sit down and talk elaborately and explain. They only do bite-size communication with the general public in their country. And because the politicians are no longer required to be erudite and eloquent and, you know, people who explain and talk at length about matters. I mean, look at Joe Biden. He can barely talk. Similarly, other leaders in Western countries, they are not really the kind of leaders that you would expect from such powerful countries.
Yeah.
And what is also very important is that you see a general dissatisfaction in Western countries with their political leadership. And this is why there is a shift towards populism and nativism. You see, like, for example, here in the Netherlands, a far-right extremist party has won most of the seats in the Dutch parliament. So there is a polarization going on in Western countries. And the Putin interview is specifically designed to address this growing fault line in Western society. He presented himself as a leader who stands for a mythology of the Russian people, the Russian state, their heritage, their identity, their culture, their religion, their moral philosophy. The reason why he spoke at length about the Eastern Church, the, you know, Kievan Rus, where the Russian, you know, the Russian ethnicity is founded, all these things, it's intended for Western audience, but also his own audience. To them, he shows a picture of a leader who is very well aware of how to appeal to the masses and make them feel proud of who they are. They're Russians. This is their identity. This is their heritage. This is who they are. You know, moving towards a more nationalist tendency within, you know, generally in that regard. And this also shows the dissatisfied and cynical masses in Western society that your leader is not a good leader. Look at me. Look at how I represent my people. So obviously, if you look at the commentary in Western society, most people who are inclined toward nativism and nationalism and who are opposed to this, you know, the mainstream media, etc., they all really loved him. They glorify him. They basically revere Putin for what he did. And it was a very calculated way of, you know, presenting himself as a new global leader. And why is this related to Afghanistan? People are asking, hey, look at him talking so much about Russia. It's because
Putin's an apologist.
Yes. So if Putin exerts himself as such a powerful figure, okay, opposed to, let's say, someone as Joe Biden, this reveals how the global dynamics have shifted. Okay. As you said, you're not that guy anymore. Yes, the unipolarity has come to an end. The United States is not the sole superpower in the world. There are new actors who are, you know, much more assertive in the way they, you know, act in the global arena. And Russia is a very significant actor. So based on these recent events, we can also understand why, for what this means for the Taliban is, like, okay, they're not allies of Russia and China. It's all calculated self-interest. It's a very rational decision. Okay, this is how the situation is set. These people are becoming more powerful. They are playing along with us, so we will play with him. You see? And this dynamic is going to explain the upcoming, you know, events in the region, in Afghanistan, but also more generally in the region. So I expect more Afghan-Russian cooperation in trade, security, and commerce, whatnot, because obviously, you know, the center of power in the world has shifted more towards the east.
Yeah, and just coming back briefly to the point that you made about Western politicians talking, you know, even discounting President Biden and his age and his inability to talk as he once did. If you just listen to the standard Western politician in the UK, for example, if you ask, hypothetically speaking, I've seen sort of examples of it so many times that I can't even think of an example. Like, Mr. Prime Minister, what do you make of energy prices? And the first thing will be like the scripted, well, I think it's very important that we bring down our energy prices. And I share this perspective. And it's so important that we reduce also our greenhouse gas emissions and la la. And then my God, like, it's all robotic and scripted. Like I said, you never get a world leader sitting down for 2 hours, rightly or wrongly, but just authentically shitting on his neighbor or another country with whom he doesn't get along. It's always the element of the soundbite, and what it's supposed to achieve is to disarm the questioner, to minimize the level of engagement as much as possible, to avoid a potentially uncomfortable conversation that would reflect badly in public. Whereas with Putin, you saw the exact, I saw it until 1:24, but with Tucker Carlson kept asking him, how is this relevant? And this time it was just Putin, you know, I'm going to talk for as long as I want to talk, as good or as bad as what I say may be, but it's startlingly different. But yeah, I think that's the UN, the Doha conference. I think we've wrapped that up pretty well. And once again, it's not just the importance of the conference, but more so, how is it important and what does it signify and mean? So with that portion of the podcast wrapped up, just looking at the conference and all of the different factors at play there, we now turn once again across the Durand line to Pakistan, which after its election that was naturally very controversial and raised a lot of attention around the world, seems to have now put together a coalition government. So on the 22nd of February, just 2 days ago, a deal was made between PMLN, or the Pakistan Muslim League, and the N stands for Nawaz Sharif, and the PPP, the Pakistan People's Party, of whom the son of Benazir Bhutto and former president Asif Ali Zardari, Bilawal Bhutto, is the head of. Now, the coalition government is one in which the prime minister that's been appointed is a former prime minister, Shahbaz Sharif, the brother of Nawaz Sharif, who was also a former prime minister. And the president is also Asif Ali Zardari, who was also formerly a president. Who was also formerly a president.
We shouldn't laugh. This is not funny. We shouldn't laugh. Okay. We're very sorry. It's not meant to, you know, be funny, but okay, let's move on.
And it's noteworthy because this comes after elections in which PMLN came second and the PPP came third. The number one were the independents that belonged to or were affiliated with the former Prime Minister Imran Khan's party, which has been proscribed and is now an illegal entity. So Just to make it clear, the party that came second entered the coalition with the party that came third amidst ongoing claims and accusations of vote rigging and fraudulent elections. After this government, so make of that what you will, the government or this newly formed coalition government has asked the IMF for $6 billion in loans for a bailout to avoid defaulting on its debts. And according to the Financial Times, and we'll link the report below, 57% of Pakistan's annual government revenue goes to interest payments on the debts. So 57% doesn't just go to the debts, but to the interest payments of the debts. And Pakistan's debt to GDP ratio stands at just under 80%. Inflation was at 38% last year. And in response to the request for relief, once again from the IMF, the former prime minister, who was democratically elected and was unable to complete his term because of a no confidence vote, that we'll also get into, Imran Khan has called on the IMF to link any bailout to a thorough election audit. So there's a lot obviously going on in Pakistan. It is a pretty troubled country in that regard. And obviously, we are broadly speaking aware of how we got here. We know that Imran Khan became the prime minister. That obviously, it was during his premiership that the Taliban took over in Afghanistan. Imran Khan was obviously in the 2000s and the 2010s very opposed to the US war on terror in Afghanistan, as well as in the tribal areas of Pakistan. His premiership coincided with the takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban, and he was then deposed in a no confidence vote in which all of these parties in parliament decided voted him out. And recently, or at the time even, there was a widespread belief, and documents were leaked alleging that this had been orchestrated by the US, which was unhappy with the fact that Imran was insubordinate as far as its interests in Afghanistan and Ukraine were concerned. Now, in the past month as well, another politician has also found an increasing convergence with Imran Khan, and that is Maulana Fazlur Rahman. So, just to broadly be aware, during Imran Khan's premiership, Maulana Fazlur Rahman was one of his most vociferous opponents, to the extent of Fazlur Rahman calling Imran Khan a Jew, based on the fact that Imran Khan was once married to Jemima Goldsmith. Now, Fazlur Rahman has come out and has made a couple of statements. By the way, Sangar, you know when I did that episode on Fazlur Rahman and I introduced him, I basically said in the podcast, Fazlur Rahman is an extremely influential politician in Pakistan. Now, I'm not in the business of trying to pontificate and adjudicate in Pakistani politics, but prominent politician, influential in Pakistan. You can't go wrong saying that, right? Whatever, wherever you stand, all of the replies to me were the guys with the PTI flag. Nah, he is a dog. He sells his religion. He is a hypocrite. But now he is together, or at least there seems to be a growing convergence between himself and Imran Khan. Now, I've got here the Pakistani outlet Dawn. On the 15th of February, they published an article. General Faiz Hamid, who was the former head of the ISI, the DGISI, and General Bajwa orchestrated the no confidence vote against Imran, claims Maulana Fazlur Rahman. There's also a video I have in which Maulana Fazlur Rahman, in a gathering, is saying that his party, which also competed in these elections, was disadvantaged and targeted by the army because of the fact that it advocated closer relations with Afghanistan. So that's, and bear in mind to everyone listening, this is my attempt at just breaking everything that's going on in Pakistan. It's a very complex country. We as Afghans, I feel, and perhaps one day we'll do an actual breakdown into Pakistani politics as Afghans, because we as Afghans, I feel, really lack not a deep knowledge, but a surface level knowledge of the different constituencies in Pakistan and how they interplay and how they interplay with Afghanistan. This is my attempt at a very brief breakdown. But this is essentially what led us to where we are, to Shahbaz Sharif again as Prime Minister, Asif Ali Zardari again as President. Now, I wanted to ask you, how do we, first of all, How do we assess Maulana Fazlur Rahman's statement that his advocacy for closer relations with Afghanistan is what got him targeted for election rigging against this party by the army?
Okay, so if we look at the current state of affairs in Pakistan, we see how the military rule is suppressing PTI. We know of the last few decades how the Pakistani military persecuted their critics, whether it's in Balochistan or in Pakhtunkhwa or in the formerly tribal.
Enforced disappearances.
Exactly. Now, throughout all these years, Maulana Fazlur Rahman's Jamiat-e-Ulama-e Islam party was active in local and national politics in Pakistan. And throughout all these years, they could basically do whatever they want. The fact that Maulana Fazlur Rahman was able to come to Afghanistan, travel to different parts of the country, and
meet the
even
Amir.
Meet the Amir, it means that he has some sort of backing from the military. Otherwise, under current circumstances, what is going on in Pakistan, how does a politician get the, you know, approval to go and talk to Taliban when there are all these tensions between Afghanistan and Pakistan? I think that he is trying to present himself as a victim, and he's trying to blame his relationship with Afghanistan for the fact that the Pakistanis are not interested in voting for him. And he is just scapegoating Afghanistan now. That's how I see
it. Okay, but then how? So there are two points here. Number one, during his visit to Afghanistan, a statement came from the Pakistani Ministry of Foreign Affairs saying that he was there in a private capacity, essentially distancing the state from Fazlur Rahman's. This isn't to say that we should believe that, take that statement at face value, but just to push back for the sake of discussion, number one. Number two is the fact that he's now come out and he's directly implicated the director general of the ISI and the former chief of the army staff for overthrowing Imran Khan. So it's not just that he's blaming poor electoral performance on the army rigging the election against him. One could say that he's actually coming out and putting himself at risk here with how inflammatory these allegations are.
I agree. The accusations are very severe. However, we have to try. Let's look at Jamiat-e-Ulama-e Islam as a party. Okay, so they are a very conservative Deobandi movement led by religious scholars. Okay. The vast majority of people who get to vote in Pakistan are not all supporters of his party or his beliefs and values and ideas. There are many competing other actors in the Pakistani politics, and we have to also bear in mind that quite a lot of people who would have voted for a party like his may have shifted towards either not voting at all because they say, well, look at the current state of affairs in Pakistan, what's the point of voting? Or they may have voted for a PTI candidate. Okay?
Or they sympathize with the TTP.
Actually, that's also a very important matter. So with all these factors in consideration, we can say that he is becoming aware of the fact that his time his era in politics is basically coming to an end. He's not that significant anymore. He's not that guy anymore. So naturally, he now benefits from the underdog position and as the opposition leader by presenting himself as some sort of a victim of oppressive military that forced him to vote against the prime minister in 2022. Huh? Like, come on, man, you are a religious scholar. You represent the religious scholarly class. And you here you are, you're saying basically that the military used you as a puppet. Okay, and then now you're saying that...
I mean, to be honest, PTI protests had a lot of freemixing going on, so...
Yeah, okay, so this is another matter. So yes, the alternatives in Pakistan are rather more liberal and progressive than his party. And this is also a factor that plays into all of this. It's like this traditional conservative guy, he's more of a, you know, someone from the past. He's not a player of the current state of affairs in Pakistan.
A has-been,
yes. So that's why it makes sense that he is now complaining. He's blaming Afghanistan. He's coming with all these accusations against the military, which I think is very credible. You know, we have...
Okay, but there's one point that I want to pick up on there, which you said he's blaming Afghanistan. What if he's not blaming Afghanistan? For the sake of discussion, what if he's not blaming Afghanistan? But what if he's... The actual point is that the current shot callers in Afghanistan seek to penalize those that want to bring together the two fraternal nations of Afghanistan and Pakistan.
I think that would play into this whole narrative of Afghanistan is the eternal enemy of Pakistan and they never want to recognize the Durand Line and they are the enemy. You know, we see that often being expressed by different politicians in Pakistan. And, you know, I would say if we are really, really critical of what has happened in the last couple of weeks in Pakistan, I would say that the only role that Afghanistan actually played in the elections in Pakistan is what I explained in the other episode with my, you know, story about Maulana Bijligar saying that, you know, people in Pakistan look on the other side of the Durand Line and think, okay, maybe that's a good way of governing the country. Maybe that's the only role that could be, you know, counted as Afghani influence in Pakistan. Other than that, I don't think that there are any real significant moves made by Afghans or Afghanistan in general that would have played any role in the Pakistani elections.
Okay, so as always with Fazlur Rahman, there's a lot to discuss and a lot of what ifs. And obviously you have to play devil's advocate to ensure that you're doing at least some level of fairness and justice to the discussion. But now, like I said, Pakistan, by all units of measurement, is not in a good place right now. Severely indebted, asking for more debt, relief from the IMF, high inflation, political instability. How does Pakistan's ongoing political crisis and the loss of legitimacy of its powerful military affect its relations with Afghanistan and Afghanistan as a whole?
I would say that the decline of the power of the Pakistani military and the growing power of political parties such as PTI is showing a change in Pakistani political dynamics where the old parties that were all part of dynasties like Muslim League or PPP, all these parties that are basically family dynasties, they're losing their power. The military is not capable of controlling the narrative on matters because the growing segment of young Pakistanis who are active on social media, they get exposed to new ideas. And this explains also why parties such as PTI are becoming more prominent, because PTI does not appeal to one particular small ethnic group in one part of Pakistan, but they are basically a very popular party in other provinces, whether it's Punjab or Pakhtunkhwa. They have their support base over there. This means that Pakistan as an entity is no longer the same powerful actor in the region, because their internal decline, their internal division is making them like incapacitated in being an actor in Afghanistan. So if they cannot have any kind of influence or any kind of, you know, if they are not a significant actor in Afghanistan, the question is, okay, so how does that affect Afghanistan? Number one, Afghanistan will not face any more threats of, you know, subversion by groups supported by Pakistan. That's number one. The second thing is that while Afghanistan is moving towards stability and engagement with the regional powers, whether it's India, China, or Russia, Afghanistan is becoming less dependent on its relationship with Pakistan, which consequently will lead into another situation where Afghanistan is no longer the small brother of Pakistan, but it's the other way around. Pakistan is now becoming the less capable member of that family in the region that is
the
basically
the small, short-tempered and slightly autistic brother.
So this is why I think, you know, it looks very bad for Pakistan, but for Afghanistan, things aren't looking that bad. At actually, you know, if Pakistan can no longer play the role of the, you know, destabilizing actor, whether it was during the Soviet occupation or the American occupation or now with the Taliban, Pakistan has always supported the opposition, and now since they are in their own internal turmoil, they can no longer play that game. Pakistan is no longer that guy.
Yeah, as in, I would agree with that in the sense that due to the collapse of an internal consensus, that is no longer able to project it and assert itself overseas. And in turn, inversely, the fissures that are opening up within Pakistan make it thus more susceptible to actually receiving influence from outside, including but not restricted to Afghanistan. But it is, genuinely speaking, a saddening situation, because Pakistan as a country has a lot of potential in terms of human capital, in terms of its geography, agriculture, all of the resources and assets that it enjoys at its disposal. And the two of us being from a country that's been misgoverned that by corrupt elites that are often more answerable to constituencies outside the country than from within the country. A country in which a dynastic identitarian brand of politics has been incubated and patronized from overseas. There are loads of things in Pakistan that we can see and relate to our own experience and suffering as Afghans. So I know some Afghans will be very angry by the fact that we don't want Pakistan to go up in flames and be destroyed. It's just the way of the game. Not much I can do about it. If they are angry, they are. But honestly speaking, in addition to the rest of the Ummah at large, I genuinely pray that they manage to put their own house in order in a way that is acceptable to the largest number of Pakistanis. And through that, all of us able to build bridges with one another. And that is my Hizb ut-Tahrir sounding monologue coming to an end.
I just would say addressing, you know, a quite large group of young Pakistanis who are gravitating towards Afghan eye, our content. And we have a very positive, you know, engagement from a lot of young Pakistanis. I would say, you know, considering the current situation, something that you all need to bear in mind, and I think it applies also for Afghans on this side of the Durand line, is that whether you like it or not, you know, we are neighbors, and you know where they say you cannot choose your neighbors, okay? So if there is instability, crisis, or whatever in Pakistan, obviously it will have its negative implications for Afghanistan and vice versa. However, Something that most Afghans and most Pakistanis probably are not aware of is that the younger generation in both countries are the absolute majority. The absolute majority of the population in both countries are young men and women. And young men and women in our current day and age, they are a force to be reckoned with. The youth are capable of shifting, you know, the dynamics in their own country and shaping the future of their country. This is why it is very important to avoid thinking in a very, you know, sensational and emotional way about international relations. Whether it's Afghanistan's relationship with Pakistan or vice versa, we have to identify what are the rational and realist interests of each country. Okay? So if it is in the interests of Afghanistan to have access to the sea ports in Pakistan, it naturally, it means that Afghanistan becomes dependent on stability in Pakistan. If Pakistan needs access to Central Asian resources, then it naturally means that Pakistan becomes dependent on stability in Afghanistan. This is basically the red line that needs to be emphasized constantly. If this is not accepted as what is the basis of the relationship between two countries, then everything else that is being said, that's just, you know, distraction. So try to focus on this matter, and I think that for both countries, this will be in our interest in the long term. And with that out of the way, do you think you want to say anything else, or should we wrap it up?
I think that's it from us. Pretty comprehensive discussion on latest developments, and that's it, I'd say.
All right. Okay. Thank you all for listening and viewing and joining us for this 7th episode of the 2nd season of the Afghan Eye podcast. If you're watching us on YouTube, make sure that you like, subscribe, and leave a comment, especially if you disagree with us. We would like to read your comments. If you're listening to this podcast on any of the platforms like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. That will help us a lot. And if you appreciate our work, you can become a patron by visiting our Patreon page. And if you'd like to make a one-off donation, please visit our PayPal page. We appreciate all the love and support that we have received in the last couple of weeks and months. Next month, we will be exactly 4 years old, so we will have a special episode. And we hope to celebrate that with you all. Maybe we will do a live stream again. So until the next episode, everyone take care of yourself and each other. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam.